Hello, everyone out there in Radioland. This here is Brian Kaplan. I'm a professor of economics at George Mason University, and I'm also a homeschooling dad. The last 2 weeks, I have been homeschooling the two gentlemen who are in the office with me, and this is their graduation day. So here we want to go and talk to people and just tell you about what we did and take some questions. Over here on my right, we've got...
Aiden Kaplan, student.
And over on my left...
Tristan Kaplan, also a student.
Now, if you think that sounds like one person, it is, in fact, two. My sons are identical twins. So when I ask questions, I'm going to try to direct it by name so you know who's talking, and then they may occasionally give you some indication of who you're listening to. Although maybe you'll figure it out from their attitude as time goes on. We'll see. All right. Now, just to start with, let's go and talk about what Kaplan Family School was like. So, just logistics. So, Aiden, how did it work?
Well, so we basically came in from 9:30 to 5:30 with a one-hour lunch break, and we did a well-rounded curriculum of mathematics, economics, history throughout the day, usually starting with math in the mornings.
Wait, came in where?
Oh, to our father's office at Carroll Hall.
Wait, where's that?
George Mason University.
I see. All right, so you've already got the schedule. Can you talk a bit more about the schedule, Tristan? How do we spend our day?
Sure. So in the mornings, we normally start with math, basically. So we started with basic algebra, worked our way up to algebra 2, and by the end, we were doing calculus. Then in the afternoons, well, first we would have a lunch break. Then we would move on to history reading. That's where we would just read books that our dad assigned us. And after history reading, we would do history writing, where we would write essays about the historical time frames that we were covering in the readings. And our dad would grade these essays once we finished them up. And at the end, we normally had what was called a reading, writing, and research period, where we just worked on whatever we were interested in. And our dad would look at that, too.
All right, now, what kind of discipline was imposed? Was it some kind of, like, iron-fisted totalitarian regime? What was going on? Give the right answer.
I would say it was fairly lax relative to public schooling. Sir, it was much more of an honor system than regular public schooling, where not cooperating with the teacher would often land you in some sort of punishment. Of course, we had so little desire to go against the schedule that there was almost never a problem.
But wait, don't all kids hate their parents? I don't understand.
I don't hate my parents. Huh. I think they're pretty much the two best people in the world, having raised
Aww,
me.
Oh, so sweet. So what about testing? Were there any tests? Tristan?
Yes, we would have tests normally every Friday, just to assess how well we were doing in math, history, all those subjects. And our dad would look at those and say if we needed to keep working on some things, et cetera, et cetera. So that helped us get a good ballparking of how we were doing.
All right, what about standardized tests?
Yeah, for standardized tests, the things we did that were most standardized, I suppose, would be the AP tests. But other than
that, wait a second! What are the AP tests?
The AP tests are advanced placement tests normally taken by high school students trying to get into colleges.
High school students trying to get in college? Wait, how old are you kids?
I am 14. I did the first AP when I was 13, though.
Whoa. All right. So, all right, tell us more.
Well, the first year of CFS, Kaplan Family School is what we call it, we practiced for the and studied for the AP U.S. history test. And our dad, of course, helped us get through that, grading our essays, telling us what we should work on, all that stuff. I don't think we could have done it without him. And we went over and got fives on that. So that was
wait,
awesome.
What's the top possible score?
Five.
Ooh, wait, both you got fives?
That's right.
Cool. What about test the second year? What happened then? Aiden?
Well, that year we did three times as many tests, which with probably less than three times the work, so it was very nice. In fact, I would say it was almost the same amount of work, and got fives on AP Microeconomics, AP Macroeconomics, and AP European History.
Huh. Wait, what do middle school kids need to learn economics for?
Well, to be economists.
to be economists. Standard career goal for every kid.
Absolutely.
All right. And then some people asked about the legality. So Virginia is a state with pretty lax rules. So since I, the father, have an advanced degree, I am immediately qualified to teach. And then There are several different ways that I can stay in line with state rules. One of them is just to get evaluated by somebody else who's got an advanced degree. And this role was ably served by Alex Tabarrok, who's across the hall. Thank you, Alex. All right. Now let's get into something, some deeper stuff. All right. So, Aiden, so what were the main motivations for us doing this anyway?
Motivations. Well, I was very unhappy with normal public schooling. It was for me, very boring because of all the music programs that we had to go through, and art, too. Let's not forget art, which, you know, all of those put together, I did not like any of them, and maybe they took up half the day on some of the days.
Half the day on music and art?
Absolutely.
What kind of a crazy school did you go to?
Hunter's Woods Elementary School for grades 4 to 6.
What I mean is some school or other in Northern Virginia. All right. And, yeah, Tristan, yeah, so motivations. What made you interested in this idea? If at all, if you were interested, who knows?
Yeah, so in addition to what Aiden was saying, I'd also say we basically did very little time on the subjects that I liked the most and I thought were most important.
Like so what?
Math, for example. We spent maybe, if we're lucky, 40 minutes a day on that.
That's back in regular school?
Yeah, it's back
in. Yeah, and how much time do you spend on that in homeschool? On math?
Roughly 2 hours. 2 hours and change.
2 hours and change. Wow, so that's like 3 times as much. Did it show in the progress we made?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I don't think there's any way we could have made it to calculus without our dad here to help us out.
All right. So we made it to calculus, or we made it through calculus?
Well, I'd say we've almost made it through. There's still some stuff we need to learn, but we're doing pretty well.
Yeah, that's pretty good. All right. Yeah, and then just for my motivations, I'd long been interested in doing something like this. I've got a job where it's really easy because I can just take my kids into my office with me. I got 2 kids that were highly motivated and very well behaved, so I could still do my job and be their teacher at the same time. But, you know, the main thing is I got to say, you know, middle school, or what we called junior high as a kid, those were the worst years of my life, and I just wanted to give my kids a better life than I had when I was a kid. So I saw they didn't seem to be very happy with school, and I put myself in their shoes and said, oh, I were them, I wouldn't be happy either. This is not a very nice way for a person to have to go through their day. So at least I could spare them, you know, some of the very bottom, and I think that's what I did. All right, yeah. So, besides these AP tests, Aiden, what are some other accomplishments we had? What do you feel like we've got? Where do you feel like we've come? From where we started? What skills do you have that you didn't have when we started? Let's put it that way.
Well, I feel like my main improvement is in my essay writing, which, you know, I've taken a look at some of the things I did in sixth grade, and I thought, wow, those are the kinds of essays that got top marks in sixth grade, and those are the kinds of essays which I would think were more or less trash right now. But,
oh, come on, you're in sixth grade.
Yeah.
You're so hard on yourself.
It was only 2 years ago.
Wait, and how exactly did you improve?
Well, the way that most people might think that is a good way of improving, which is through practice. You write the essays, they're graded, you get comments on them about what you need to work on, and then from there you get better.
So about how many essays did we do over the last 2 years?
I wasn't really keeping count, but I would say probably 80, maybe 100.
80 or 100 each?
Yeah, 80 or 100 each.
Well, that's quite a lot. All right, now how about educational philosophy? Would you call what we were doing unschooling?
Definitely not. Unschooling would be basically just letting us do our own thing, and we would not have been happy with that.
You wouldn't have been happy with unschooling?
No, not at all.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Well, like, that would just leave me, like, not really knowing what to do, and having the sense that I was basically just being huddled off to do, do stupid stuff I didn't know was important. You know, I had low wisdom. I still have low wisdom, I admit it. I don't know what I'm supposed to do, how I can improve without help from the wiser, older people.
Right? So, I mean, did we just try to duplicate the regular school curriculum then?
Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah.
The part of the SIFT was trying to get rid of that material.
So you know, how would you say that it was that our day was different from a regular day in sixth grade?
Well, in sixth grade, like I believe Aiden already said, we would spend maybe about half of it doing art, music, stuff like that. Here at CFS,
half the day. Yeah, it's still hard to believe.
Yeah, here at CFS, we just totally cut that. It was all down the drain.
But music and art are super fun.
Not to me. I hate music and art. I mean, I like listening to music. I'll admit I don't like art in any form. But I like listening
about
to
movies?
Music, but I
like
don't
movies?
Like performing it.
You like movies?
If you can count that as art.
Yeah. You write stories? That's art? It's all art. Yeah. So, and actually, I'd say you got to listen to a lot more music than you ever would in regular school.
Yeah, that's
because what were you guys listening to?
Normally we would just turn on some quiet classical music while we were doing our work, listen to that. Our dads gave us a whole briefing on all the composers he thought was worth listening to. We learned a lot there.
But kids don't like classical music. Kids like modern music. They like pop.
Yeah, that's probably right, but I'm not like those other kids, really.
Huh, that's interesting.
As you might have guessed.
Huh. Wait, is this something I brainwashed you into?
No, it is not something you brainwashed us into. From a very early age, I always hated this loud, like, nasty, popular music. Yeah. I thought people were crazy for listening to it.
All right. Now, one question I'm just going to handle on my own. What are we doing next? We just finished middle school, and Aiden and Tristan are starting regular high school on Monday. Why? I'm just going to be brief on that. It's a family decision. Not everybody in the family is totally on board, so that's what's happening. All right, and now, the fun parts. I put out on Facebook that I was going to be doing this podcast, so I got a whole bunch of questions from different friends, and now we'll just go through some of them. All right, so here's one. How about Aiden? If you could do it over again, what would you do differently?
That's a great question. All right, so...
this is, by the way, from Michael Chonchev.
I see, all right. Yeah, so... I think I would probably have us do more in the first year because I think we did more or less more impressive stuff in the second year. When I feel like we probably could have done that much in the first year too, or maybe just a little less. So I feel like we probably could have done more in the first year, maybe tossed in some more economics, and that would have freed up more time to do stuff in the second year.
So more work. We should have worked harder.
Yeah, I feel like that's so.
So would you rather just cut into the free research period and done more standard stuff, or what?
Yeah, for a lot of days. Yeah. I mean, I feel like for some of the research periods, I didn't have a clear idea of what I should be doing, going back to the unschooling thing.
Right, but you did often use that to go and just read Wikipedia on stuff relevant.
That's quite true.
Yeah, right, so, and what about you, Tristan? If you could do it over again, what would you do differently?
I think Aiden's answer is pretty good. Ultimately, I think the one thing I would do differently would be basically just try to read more Wikipedia and stuff using the internet as a resource more often. Mm-hmm. I think, especially in the first year, our AP US textbook, although it offered some direction, it was just not that good. So I think if we used the internet more to our abilities.
That textbook was, by the way, the best US history textbook that I could find. So it was called Nation of Nations. Was never thrilled by it, but still, compared to the competition, still stood out, so that's why we used it. See, how about this, also for Michael, so what do you feel you did great?
So I feel like the one department the one department where I've improved the most is undoubtedly my essay writing skills, which, like, we did so much practice with it, especially in the months before the AP tests, that I feel like I improved from the 10th percentile, not for my age, but objectively, and then maybe raised it to the 70th or 80th, so I feel like that was...
10th percentile of adults or college graduates?
10th percentile of adults. By adults, I mean professors. So. I have a high bar. I know.
So it's not college graduates. Yeah. All right. And then, Tristan, what do you feel you did great?
Yep. Essay writing. Although it wasn't just essay writing per se. I was also working on, reader writing and research projects. So I think I was writing a lot of fiction stories and so on. Which
Ooh, cool. What kind of fiction?
Well, early on, I was doing like horror stories and so on.
Horror?
Yeah.
You don't seem disturbed.
Well, I'm not. I think it's a cool genre, and I wanted to work at it to see what I could write.
Suspicious. All right. Now here's another one for you. Also for Michael. Did you feel other kids treated you differently for being homeschooled? What about adults?
So to be honest, I didn't actually talk to many other kids during the homeschooling experience, but like all the ones I ever talked to, they haven't treated me any differently for it. It doesn't seem like they really care. Possibly they don't even really notice that I'm homeschooled, but
Well,
yeah,
it's something
that I'll know better after like maybe 1 or 2 months in public high school.
All right. Well, what about adults?
And as for adults, I think a lot of professors had more respected me more for the homeschooling because I was more intelligent and had intelligent things to say rather than the dumbed down version of me I was in sixth grade. So,
so shame. All right, and what do you say about that, Tristan? Yeah. So other kids and adults treatment.
Yeah, again, I think the few kids we interacted with were, like, practically as weird as us, so it's not like they would judge us for doing something that's weird. They would, if anything, like that. The most normal kids I would meet would probably be, like, my cousin, I would say. C didn't seem like that disturbed or anything. In fact, I think C wanted to be homeschooled, too, after hearing how great we had it. Let's see. And then I'd say for adults... Yeah, I think many of the adults we interacted with, there was, like, at first subsets of their homeschool that's a little weird, but, like, you know, like, for some of them, for the rest, it was basically just respect and say, yeah, you know more. Your dad's a smart guy. He'll steer you right.
Wait, Dad, so what about the Germans? What did the Germans think about our homeschooling experiment?
Well, you know how homeschooling is completely...
By the way, why would the Germans even come up?
Oh, yeah, because our dad took the family over to roughly a month in Münster, Germany. It's a nice city.
Yeah, very nice.
By capital of Germany. But, yeah, since homeschooling is completely illegal in Germany, all the Germans were very disturbed to hear that we were being homeschooled. Our dad basically just says it all in his German accent. It's like, what's a homeschooled? How can this be? But Sally's estate tells you what to look at and what to work on. And I said, no. What? Then they don't tell you how to do anything? That's right. Oh my god! The sky is falling!
Yeah, it was fun. It's fun freaking out the Germans, I gotta say. Yep, so now a few things were recently said that I think will be terrifying a lot of listeners. So, Aiden mentioned just not spending much time with kids your own age, and Tristan talked about spending time with weird kids your own age. What's going on?
Well, so I have the view that it's not actually very important to talk to kids your own age, because kids your own age grow up to be adults. So adults are the important people to be talking to and figuring out how their psychology works and so on, and I feel like that the homeschooling experience really prepared me for, especially as I want to be an academic, so I'm around tons of academics especially.
Wait, but aren't kids your own age a lot more fun than a bunch of professors who are balding?
No, I don't really think so. They all start out like conformist or in some other way not really fun to talk to.
It can't be that bad. Can't be all of them.
All of them, but like there's a lot of search value involved, so it's hard to find these weird kids and sort of convert them.
All right, Tristan, let's hear about some of the weird kids. I like them.
Sure. So you heard about the Professor Tabarrok, who signed our papers and so on to make sure that everything was kosher for more homeschooling. He has two sons, Max Tabarrok and Connor Tabarrok, who I'm big fans of. And they're pretty weird, and just like their father, I'd say. No offense to any of them, I like weirdness. But anyway, yeah, so they seem perfectly okay with that, and then also we converted more... there's basically some other kids. Max knew a few. Liam, for one.
Cool.
He was also pretty okay.
Yeah, we also just spent a couple weeks hanging out with some other kind of weird kids in France, right?
Yep, that's right.
Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, it's mostly British kids from boarding schools, although there were also some Americans and then some, you know, people scattered from all kinds of countries.
How did this all happen? What was going on?
Our dad got invited for roughly a month in France the year after he got invited for a month in Germany at the Château de Molay. John Locke Institute ran it entirely.
In Normandie, France.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, and so who are these? So these kids were what? They were college kids. What were they?
They were high school students. For the most part. A few were younger, a few were older, but yeah.
All right. Let's see. All right, here's one that we kind of already touched on, but from my friend Andre Salazar. So, did you follow traditional curriculum, or did you allow room for other subjects or early specialization?
So definitely did not follow traditional curriculum. It was about as untraditional as you can get. Except for unschooling.
Yeah. So we did a lot of reading and writing and math, so I'd say three R's, that's pretty traditional, isn't it?
Well, the way we did it was the way we did it. I would say,
okay,
unconventional but highly effective. And I feel like that is really the qualification for traditional versus untraditional curriculum.
Yeah. So, like, what were some of the early specializations we experimented with, Tristan?
Specializations. Well, we tried to specialize in the subjects that interested us the most. So, specifically, economics and history.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the two main things. We worked hard on that. And I think we've ultimately succeeded in being way more knowledgeable at history and economics than we could have ever been at normal schools.
Let's come back to that at the end. We've got to strut our stuff a bit. All right. So, here, Tristan, here's a question from Justin Zielinski. Do you think your time was spent in a manner that you in 10 years will believe was overall useful?
Yeah, I really hope so, because the me in 10 years will hopefully be like the me right now. I like the me right now. I don't want him to change that much. you could do with some improvements, I'll admit, but overall, that's fine. So I think right now I think that the time spent was incredibly useful. I doubt that will change, and if it does, it probably won't change that much. It'll change to be either not quite as useful as I thought, or more useful even than I thought. So I think ultimately, yeah, everything that we've done here will be very useful.
All right, what do you think, Aiden? So remember, so in 10 years, you'll be, what, 24?
Yeah.
All right, so, useful? How useful?
So I think it'll be super useful in having given us a massive academic boost, which will hopefully be very good for college and so on. I more or less agree with what Tristan said. I feel like the most likely direction is for me to consider it going up rather than down in terms of how useful it was.
Yep. Yeah, so, I mean, when I was designing the curriculum, the main thing that I didn't want to be flexible about was math, because I think that's something that, on the one hand, it's not that fun for a lot of people, but it really does open up a lot of doors. So that's why we put in almost 2.5 hours every day into math. And then for the other stuff, as long as it had a big reading and writing component, I was pretty flexible. So since they were interested in history, you know, we didn't really do like English literature in a normal way. Instead, we just read history books, but we still did a lot of reading and we did a lot of writing. So I think that's all we needed to do. And then in terms of fiction, both of you were writing fiction during research time, which a lot of it is very good. All right. So we got a question from Scott Gibb. All right. So it seems to me that the K-8 years might be more important than most people assume. How would you describe the relative importance of K-8 to the high school years? This is for me. I guess I just don't know that much. I mean, my main view is that you can get a pretty good prediction about how successful a person's going to be by normal metrics just with an IQ test, or then maybe add on some personality tests to get a little bit more information. In terms of how useful it is, I mean, I say most people forget most of what they learn, so I don't think they're getting much out of that. There's always the compared to what question. So is school really useful compared to being home alone playing video games? Then yes. Is it really useful compared to something else you might be doing instead? That's not so clear to me. And so, as long as you're out interacting with people. Yeah, and so by the way, so you guys, were you kept in isolation? It was just the two of you guys and me, or Aiden? So, like, what kind of social interaction did we get?
Oh, well, the professors would come by every day and every Friday, and more frequently for days we weren't technically supposed to be there. we got to go out to lunch with them, which was nice. Mm-hmm. And of course, college students came by asking about where Dad was usually, although sometimes they would be waiting for a while, and we got to talk to them as well.
Huh, what about games?
Oh, yeah, so we also did some role-playing games throughout the school year. So we started off with Dad's role-playing game, Punctuated Equilibrium, with three college students plus the two of us and Dad GMing. And more of the same as the year progressed.
Hey, Tristan, what do you think about all these college students? Don't name names. What's general picture? George Mason undergraduates. What's their deal?
Right. So we actually attended two of our dad's college classes.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yep. Labor and public choice class. So the labor class and public choice, both, most of the students seem to be somewhat apathetic. They aren't that interested in the class. and they don't do as the homework normally. They don't study as hard as they should, anything like that. But you can definitely find some very
most of them kind of do the homework.
Kind of, but you know,
yeah, really. It's attendance that's shockingly low.
Attendance is low, and like even the students who score the best on the tests aren't even normally the ones who show up that often. So it's a little odd.
All right, here's another one from Scott Gibb. All right, so obviously Aiden and Tristan had to work very hard to obtain the scores they did. What did you say to motivate them? All right, Aiden, what did I say to motivate you?
Well, where to even begin? Well, you gave numerous speeches based usually off of ones from historical literatures, also Shakespeare. You gave us some St. Crispin's Day type speeches.
I did. I didn't remember that.
Yeah, like the day before test.
Day. Oh, the day before the test. But to motivate you to do the work day in and day out.
Yeah, I feel like I'm actually the sort of person who doesn't need that much motivation, and you were sort of just there in the back room, and that was enough for me to know that there was someone there in case anything went wrong.
Yeah, Tristan, what was I saying to motivate you?
Well, part of it is you were saying how these tests that we were trying to take would be super important. I believed you, of course, because you're the kind of guy who would know exactly about that. So there was that. Then also, there's also just the underlying thing that we would have to go back to regular public school if, you know, we just didn't like it. And obviously public school to me would have been given how bad it was, homeschooling would have to been terrible before I would go back.
Huh. And here's also from Scott, so hypothetical criticism of Brian, quote, "Brian is pushing his kids too hard academically. Looking at the test results of Kaplan Family School, there's no way he hasn't become a tiger dad. He should lighten up, just as he tells his readers in Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids," one of my books. End quote. Why isn't this accurate? Or is it? So, was I a tiger dad?
Absolutely not. You retained your dolphin personality throughout the whole year, throughout both years, I would say.
Huh. So how do we get these high scores if I was just like a freaking hippie?
Well, you managed to not waste our time, so unlike normal public high schools, which normally have their students working maybe three times as hard to get maybe less than one-third the results, and you had a genius way of working out the schedule, assigning time slots, so it didn't have to be that way, thing which I appreciate a lot.
Bettering me up, all right. And, what do you think, Tristan, about that? So, was I a tiger dad? Give the right answer. Don't shame our family.
You were definitely not a tiger dad. You're always super nice to be around, and that's great. So I would say, just like how this happened, how we got our good scores without dad being a tiger dad, well, a lot of it is just that, like Aiden said, we don't need that much motivation. If we're told that something is going to be important, yeah, we study for that, and we're going to make sure that we're as good at it as possible when we finally do take that test.
So. Hmm. Yeah, so the time that I felt closest to being a tiger dad was the 4 to 6 weeks before the AP tests, because that was when we did constant test prep. In general, what I tried to do was teach the subject well, and then, before the test, teach the test. So first, for economics, for example, the AP micro and macroeconomics tests just are not that good. It's a very narrow subset. It's not really what I would teach in the class. But I just used Cowan and Tabarrok's intro text, and we just tried to learn the subjects well. And then, once we had learned the subjects well, then we narrowed our focus to prepping for the test. And that's where, how many practice tests did we do?
Well, so for U.S. history, I would say we did 10 to 15.
Right.
And then
how long are these tests? These
3 hours and 15 minutes
so
each.
So 3 hours and 15 minutes times 10 to 15.
Yeah, and then every other day we'd have a 1 hour long SAT subject test in U.S. history.
Yep.
Although a lot easier. That's
right. Right, and how about in 8th grade? So, Tristan, how many of those micro, macro, and European practice tests do we do?
Yeah, so the micro macro are quite a bit shorter. They're roughly an hour shorter than the AP Euro or AP US. Those were easier. Those are only maybe about 2 hours and change. And then the AP Euro is, again, as long as the AP US. So on average, I'd say we spent maybe about twice as much test prepping for those tests.
How many individual tests?
Oh, I see. So for combining micro individually would have been maybe about 12.
Twelve,
and then macro roughly the same, and then AP Euro, I'd say we only did like eight.
Eight, yeah, which is harder to get them.
Yeah.
All right, so now we got some questions from Monique Van Hawk, who is the wife of Alex Tabarrok, mother of Connor and Max Tabarrok, and also professor in the Biodefense Department right here at George Mason. All right. So, first one. What are Aiden and Tristan most looking forward to upon returning to regular school? It won't be the school lunches. Conversely, what are they most concerned about? If that's not too personal. All right. So, Aiden, let's try not to give a complete cop-out answer here.
Yeah.
What are you most looking forward to?
Most looking forward to? Well, perhaps we should let Tristan answer this question.
Tristan?
Well, I'm looking forward to at least trying to assemble a group of people who are interested in the same things I am. Maybe assembling a gaming group, that would be pretty awesome.
Yeah, that would
be. It's a bit of a fantasy, but I think I can make it happen.
Yeah, totally. All right. And what are you most concerned about?
Probably just like the hours and hours of extra work for far less benefit. Seems like for instance, I get on the orientation day, I get a page saying we should start collecting empty food containers, and I'm like, oh god.
Wait, this already happened?
Yes, already happened at the orientation day. We should important to do. Note at the top: start collecting empty food containers. Oh man, why do I have to do this? It doesn't seem useful at all.
What subject is this even for?
It's for biology. You're probably gonna look at the nutrition labels or something like that, and tell us what's inside.
Can't learn biology without having without trash, right?
Certainly not. But they specify they have to be clean, though.
All right. So let's see. Also from Monique is, as teacher in chief of Kaplan Family School, what your next project be? What we do with all this free time? So second question first. Actually, the amount of time that this really required wasn't very much. I was just taking them to my regular office, and I didn't have to do any kind of discipline or authority or anything like that. Aiden and Tristan, I would give them their work, and they do their work. So really, there were only two main sources of work that I had to do. So one of them was just designing the curriculum. So that probably I spent about 50 hours on each year. So, but that spread out over a long time. Big part of that was just textbook selection, figuring out which books to use. Buying practice books, things like that. Also just time management. Sometimes they go fiddle with the schedule when if they were getting ahead or behind in one subject so that we could stay on track. So we always had those AP tests coming up in May we needed to stay on schedule for. And then the other thing that took a lot of time was grading, but really just essays. So the essays, there wasn't really any way that I could outsource that, so I would just go and sit down, and not only would I go over them with a red pen, but we'd spend quite a bit of time going over them, because that's, I think, the way that you really learn to improve your writing is by the torture of sitting down line by line and being told that things are not perfect. I think, was it both of you said that was actually your least favorite part of the experience?
Yep. Well, it's tough getting criticism face-to-face. I eventually learned to deal with it.
Yeah, so.
Took it well by the end.
Yeah, that was all well. And then, and then during the 4 to 6 weeks before the AP test, then there was an enormous amount of grading there. But for stuff like math, usually what I would do is, first tell them, I got good textbooks, and then say, first of all, if you're confused, talk to each other. Second of all, Google, and only third, come to me. And that system worked out really well. So, sometimes I was actually posting hard geometry problems on Facebook where I couldn't figure them out, and I've got enough math. I've got enough math nerds once there's a geometry problem, you have to do it without Trig. Anyway, so I had my math nerds out there to go and help me out. So that cut down on my time too. So the crowdsourcing. Let's see. Right, and then this fits in with a question from. A question from Ben Henry. So he said, "How do you fit any homeschooling in with your job as a professor?" So since I was a professor, I just brought my kids in, and not only was it easy, I could still do my job, but gave them a lot of opportunities for enrichment. So I took them on trips, not just to, University of Münster in Germany or John Locke Institute seminar in France. Took them on a Harvard, Princeton, Yale tour. They got to meet, who do we meet at Harvard?
Of course. So we met Lant Pritchett and also Steven Pinker.
And
Greg Mankiw.
And Greg Mankiw, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so those are some people we met there. Whenever I had speakers come in, try to introduce you, see if you can get some value out of them. All right. Yes. Let's see. All right. Now, here is a question from a Facebook friend that I knew back in high school, Denise Dardarian. All right, so it's actually a much longer comment, but I'll just read the beginning, which I think is probably speaking for a vast number of listeners. All right. How do the boys feel about missing out on the school experience, not going to football games, not attending homecoming and prom dances, not hanging out with their friends during lunch or after school, not participating in school sports, band, or other activities, not having favorite teachers and least favorite teachers, having a part-time job, saving up their money for a car, getting their driver's licenses, crushes on girls and or asking a girl out, going out on dates? So I think she may have thought they were in high school rather than middle school, although most of this would apply either way. All right, so how do you feel about everything you missed out on?
I don't really feel like I missed out on much of anything. I'm an extremely introverted person, and I really have no desire to...
But it's homeschooling that did that horrible thing to you,
no,
right?
No, I've always been introverted and shy. I didn't really have many friends back in public school. I knew almost everyone in the class, but I didn't actually talk with them that much. So.
But the more introverted you are, the more important it is to throw you in with a bunch of kids, isn't it?
No, I don't think so. It's sort of like a broken window fallacy.
All right, and Tristan, so how do you feel about everything that was taken away from you? You had it all back in sixth grade, and I ripped it from your hands.
This is kind of like saying that he took away something I never had, because I was never trying. I never really wanted to do any of those things. A lot of what homeschooling did was like teach me how to improve on the things that I did badly, and yes, that included talking to girls. Say, we had social skills lessons. Our dad arranged for that. Otherwise I'd be too intimidated to even think about trying to improve it. And yeah, I know I'm not that good and pretty bad at it, but I've improved a lot, and that's something.
Alright. So. Huh. But I still feel like a lot of people are there, their stomachs churning, the hair on their back of their neck standing up, feeling like they're in the presence of some horrible evil. So, but every kid likes this stuff, right? Every kid likes being in band and going to football games and prom.
No, I'm afraid not. I mean, you know these kids. They were probably, like, in the back of the classroom, you know, Sadie stuff going on there. But there were definitely kids in any school you went to, I'm willing to bet, that just did not like the system. They didn't want to be there. And they were probably pretty angry at the system, too, for making them be there. And I was one of those kids. I was one of the kids who sat in the room constantly thinking, God, this is so stupid. I don't want to be here. Please take me somewhere else because I don't want to listen to school spirit stuff about football games. I want to just quietly learn. And why are you stopping me from quietly learning? Why are you forcing me to care about these things? Because it's never going to happen. And I don't want to learn about them anyway. I just want to go and learn about the stuff which interests me. And I know there's lots of kids where that kind of stuff interests them. That's fine by me. But don't try to force that stuff on me because it's not going to have any effect, and I'm just going to be miserable because of it.
But wait, if you don't do band and football games and proms, how will you ever get a job or marry or have children?
Well, you can ask this man over here. Oh, because it worked out pretty well for him, I think.
Oh, yeah.
How many times did you ever go to the prom, Dad?
Let's see. Counting senior prom? No times.
Right. And are you married?
Yeah, I am married, actually.
Right. You got four kids, right?
I have four. Wow.
Yeah. So how did it work out for you?
Yeah, so I got to say, whenever people go and give me these speeches about how my kids are missing out on stuff, I always remember what it was like for me, and I had all these things, and you know what I wanted? The opportunity to not have them. People feel it. I totally get that a lot of people really enjoy this stuff, but the idea that everybody does, it's just like, look around. There's other people who have other experiences. We're not very loud because we're not very popular, but it doesn't mean we're not there rolling our eyes saying, I don't like this. When people say you have to give them opportunities, usually what I find is what they mean is you have to ram a certain choice down their throats, even though there's no real reason to think that it's going to redound to their benefit later. So, you know, if I had a kid who didn't want to learn how to read, I'd make him learn how to read, because there it's very clear that he'd really be cutting himself off from the future. But a kid who doesn't want to dance, doesn't want to play an instrument, doesn't want to draw, what are they cutting themselves off from? It's something that most people never have and don't even miss. Right, and on the other hand, there's so many things that schools don't bother to teach. You know, selling movies. You don't get cinematography or filmography in school. So, and I do feel sorry for people who don't know their movies very well. Although I also notice that most people who don't know their movies don't seem to miss it. So, you know, live and let live. All right. Here's a question from Christopher Ryan. What is the least income the family can make to make homeschooling work? I mean, I would actually say you could do this on almost any level of monetary income. Mm-hmm. So there is the issue about, you know, like having one parent around to do it. So if both my wife and I had jobs where we couldn't have kids around, this would have been a lot harder. So, I mean, I still would have been open to it, but it's not the same because then, like, I could give them their work at the beginning of the day and I could come home at the end of the day and help them out. But in the middle of the day, they would just be on their own, where I still think they could learn and have a good time, but it wouldn't be the same kind of warm experience that you get when you're actually with your parents all day. So I'd say, you know, if you got parents that can, that, you know, if a parent that has either a flexible job or just, you know, or is to stay at home, then it works well. But, you know, so much of it is really just about the behavior of the kids. So, you know, if Aiden and Tristan were typical teens, then I probably wouldn't have done it because I couldn't have done my work. They'd be interrupting me or complaining so much that I couldn't really focus on it. And by the way, so before we did this, we actually started homeschool a month before regular school. So we'd have a 1 month trial period so we could actually see whether it would work. Right. So, you know, I'm not the kind of person to try a radical idea without testing it first. Right. So, remember we talked about the so-called utopian socialists? So the utopian socialists are really what deserve to be called the scientific socialists. Because, why is this, Aiden?
Well, the utopian socialists actually conducted experiments in the sense that they would get the money together to form some sort of socialist community and sort of let it go about as they envisioned it. And in most of the cases, as we see with New Harmony, which was Robert Owen's utopian community in the United States, it failed. Anyway, this is the exact opposite experiment. Experiments can succeed or they can succeed right. or fail. Right. I say this one succeeded.
Yes, but at least...
Yeah. Yeah. And this,
yeah, at least you got a big new idea experiment check it out. So, props to the unjustly maligned utopian socialists. You know, they were the real scientific ones, and it was the Marxists who were the utopians.
Yeah, don't be Marx criticizing his critics with "that's unscientific."
Yeah,
no, it's a good question. Right. Answer it.
All right. So now you may be surprised, but for the first 6 years of their lives, Aiden and Tristan's main language was not even English; it was Romanian. So they had a Romanian nanny who really only spoke Romanian from the Iași area of Romania, so sort of a country accent. Yeah. Their mom, lived in Romania till she was seven, so her Romanian's almost fluent at least. And then I spoke English, but still most of your time it was spent speaking and listening to, it's Romanian. Anyway, so I got a question here from Doamna Eugenia, the first nanny's daughter, Irina. All right, so it says, questions for all of us. So what do you like most about homeschooling and the least? All right, Tristan, what do you like most about homeschooling?
I guess the thing I liked most about homeschooling was the rearranging research period where I could work on whatever I wanted. I thought that was always really fun. I got a lot out of it, too.
Hmm. And the least?
The thing I liked least about homeschooling? The honest answer is at the very beginning, there were our dad had us do swimming classes, and I didn't like that. But if you want something to occur throughout the entire time, then I guess that would technically just be the exercise period.
Yeah.
I realized it was still useful, but I just didn't enjoy it that much.
Yeah, we played some tennis. It wasn't that bad, was it?
No, but I just yeah. this lesson's worth
all right, all right. So, Aiden, what did you like most about homeschooling?
Let's see. Probably building myself up in terms of academia, so starting from basically nothing. And
wasn't quite nothing.
Yeah, no, it's 7 years of seven years of public high school. Doesn't or, really
well, public elementary school.
Public elementary school, I'm saying. Yeah, I can't believe I got that wrong. Yeah, they're practically indistinguishable, actually. So I'm not actually...
Well, we haven't really started high school. I think there's going to be some differences.
Take a look at the school supplies list for kindergarten and for ninth grade. But let me tell you, if you have a ninth grader, buy him two sets of kindergarten.
Kindergarten supplies.
It'll be about right.
Yeah, colored pencils. You need crayons?
Color. You just need colored pencils.
All right, we've moved crayons. On from crayons.
Well, not sure if crayons are in the school supply list for kindergartners either, though.
No, they are.
Yeah, you need crayons. Yeah, come on. All right, and how about the least? What do you like least about homeschooling?
Yeah, so Tristan's answer about the swimming, I agree with that. Although, in terms of what was emotionally more difficult for me, the receiving criticism for the essays, at least at first, that didn't really feel so good. They didn't really feel so good to me. But after a while, I learned to like it. And
was that because I was super mean when I gave you?
No,
comments?
you were just giving candid feedback, something I had never received before.
This stinks. You call yourself a writer?
No, you always gave me good feedback, and at first it was hard, but.
All right, and then also from Marina, did you study any foreign languages during homeschooling years?
No, we did not study any foreign
languages. Oh, you forgot? You did. Wasn't a lot. Don't you remember?
German.
Yeah.
A tiny bit.
Yeah, so before we went to Germany, I gave you a few German lessons.
Yeah,
I
probably speak more German than Spanish. Kind of
barely any German.
Yeah. I mean, we just did a few lessons before we went, just so you could have a little bit of basic. Yeah. You knew enough to order croissants at the Bäckerei.
Drei Soko croissant in bitter.
Yes.
Three Czech.
Right. That's right. Yes. So, and some people also ask, what are some of the hardest subjects to teach in homeschooling? Right. So, I guess this is back to Monique Van Hawk. So, what subjects do you feel most challenged to cover in your homeschooling? What are your thoughts about those subjects and how to deal with them? I've been homeschooled for several years now. The stuff that I did these 2 years, pretty much all of it I felt was easy for me to do. I get, U.S. and European history, I know that stuff very well. Actually all four tests, AP tests that they did, I did when I was in high school. And I did them much later. So I did U.S. history when I was in 11th. Actually, U.S. and European history when I was in 11th grade. U.S. I had a class for, European I was self-taught, and then I did micro macro self-taught in 12th grade. So I got fives in the history, but I only got fours on the econ test. So I was proud that my sons in 8th grade knew more econ than I did when I was at the end of 12th grade. Even though I am now a professor of the subject. Looking forward, so if we had been continuing homeschooling for high school, I saw, two big issues. So first of all, it was foreign language, where, I could kind of teach them German, but I'm nowhere near fluent. And certainly I wouldn't be able to prep them for the AP German with any degree of competence. So my thinking there is that if we were doing it, I would have emailed someone over in the foreign language department here at George Mason and asked them whether they've got either a graduate student or maybe just an undergraduate who's already fluent in the language who wants to make some extra money, and then probably combine that with some online tools. So, just in terms of the gamification of learning foreign language, there's games where they test pronunciation now. They seem pretty good. So probably would have tried that. I also was thinking about if I could get a semester abroad, just to take them with me and put them in some kind of immersion class in a language that has an AP test, so we could prove to the colleges that we knew our stuff. And then for natural sciences, also I'm very weak there, so I never did any natural science APs. So for math, I've gone pretty far, but I've only had basic biology, this was honors biology, honors chemistry, and then I did one semester of college physics at Cal State Northridge, which is probably a lot easier than doing honors physics in high school at Granada Hills High School. So for those subjects, I was thinking quite a bit about what to do. So that way, since we'll be done with calculus pretty soon, then physics, just doing the calculus-based physics seemed like a way of, something that we'd be pretty well prepared for. I've got Robin Hansen across the hall, who's very good in physics, to say the least. Actually at a level that to me is a superhuman, but I know there's other people who are that good, but I could never be that good at a subject like that. And then for other things, again, I was just thinking about getting tutors from around campus. Possibly with large cash bonuses if we could get fives on the AP tests, if someone were interested in that deal. But yeah, those are the main things where I felt challenged, like I just didn't really know enough. But for everything that I was doing, So some of the stuff I felt I'd kind of forgotten, you know, for like the history, like the details I've forgotten, but it's also something where if you know the broad outlines, then it's just not that big of a deal to be shaky on the details. You can just double check. Whereas if I just didn't know it at all, then it's a different matter. All right. And speaking of Robin Hanson, I've got a question from him. The obvious question, obvious to Robin, very non-obvious and meta to everybody else. The obvious question is how Aiden and Tristan think regular school will change they and their views to be followed up a year later with how accurate those expectations turn out to be. So how will public school change you and what you think?
My hope is that it won't change me at all.
You don't want to learn anything.
Well, yes. not a lot of the stuff, but yeah, in terms of learning things, for a lot of stuff, I don't feel like I could learn that much, but I'm not.
Right.
Of course, that's something I say with very little
yes.
empirical evidence, so I would say I'll probably learn more than I expect to learn right now, and in terms of my views, those will probably stay more or less constant.
Right. And what do you think, Tristan?
I think probably I'll learn something. Nowhere near as much as I would learn if I stayed here. I might learn some more things in subjects like Spanish or something.
Mm-hmm.
That's possible.
Yeah. Well, if we're homeschooling, we'd really have to start a foreign language for college.
Yes. More than possible. Mm-hmm. But I think another change that I expect to happen will be that I'll just become more Kaplanian in my views of the education system.
I'll
probably get more mad at it and eventually just grow to accept the signaling model more than I already have. Which
you're already like the 99th percentile of Kaplanianism.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, well. So, yeah, that brings me to the question of the obvious and blatant massive brainwashing that was done to you here. Clearly, I just took a couple of innocent children who didn't know what was what, and I just poured my views into them using every kind of manipulation, intimidation to make you agree with me, and that's what happened, right? I mean, I could even leave the room so you can tell the people out in Radioland about the level of brainwashing that you endured.
Yeah, I know this is exactly what a brainwashed person would say, but I wasn't brainwashed.
Exactly. Only a brainwashed person would deny their own brainwashing. Yeah. Well, why does it seem like brainwashing to other people, then?
Yeah, that's a good question. I feel like there's something about having like a father who's like the sole instructor and who's like giving the students like all the, I don't know, but like they could probably explain it better than I can, which is unfortunate. But
yeah, what do you think? All right, brainwashed? How brainwashed are you, Tristan?
Am I more in agreement with your views than I would have been if I had just been out in normal school? I think that's probably right. But on the other hand, I think that you haven't tried to brainwash us in the sense that any normal person would call brainwashing. You've introduced us to libertarian thought and so on. But, you know, if we didn't like it, we could always say it's all crap, but it doesn't seem like it's all crap to me. I think, people like Milton Friedman, they've got a good point to make, and they make it well. And, you know, it's not like we're living in a we're studying in a building where everyone is an anarcho-capitalist. They're pretty far from it, in fact. And of course, let's not forget the fact that Dad gave us textbooks frequently written by non-libertarian people. For instance, our history textbook, authored by Carlton J.H. Hayes, a normal Wilsonian Democrat. This was written about 100 years ago.
Yep. So, by the way, When I was in high school, like I said, I just was self-taught in European history. So I learned most of what I know from an historian named Carlton Hayes, who has social and political history of modern Europe or something like that.
Political and social history of modern Europe.
As well as numerous other books.
Yeah. So when I was looking around for European history textbooks, I didn't like any of the ones that I saw that much. So I just tried out the ones that I liked, and they really did take to them. So Carlton Hayes is. Certainly no libertarian, all barely economically literate actually, but still just a very fun, opinionated professor writing in 1916. And then for the 20th century, that was actually kind of hard. But yes, we had like that Modern Civilization book or whatever. Civilization of the West. But that one actually for the 20th century was very thin. So I think
the exam itself is very thin. For most of
right. You know, most of that I think we just learned on our own. So yeah, speaking of brainwashing, all right. So homeschooling movie Captain Fantastic. All right, so
now that's a good one.
Yes, one of our favorite movies. So Viggo Mortensen plays a crazy homeschooling dad, a hippie survivalist making his kids live out off the grid in Oregon. All right, so was he brainwashing his kids?
Yeah, I don't think so. It seems like his kids challenge him a lot and so on, especially his eldest children. So it seems like the older mm-hmm. they are, the more they challenge him. But mm-hmm. In the film, anyway.
Yeah, what do you think? Was Captain Fantastic brainwashing them?
I mean, it's easy to say that he was if you look at the movie just like from the first view. But if you look closely, like oftentimes Captain Fantastic will challenge his kids' ideas, and his kids will challenge his ideas. And yeah, I think they're all in some way they're going to be a lot like him. They're going to agree with a lot of his views by the time they're older, and they'll be more in sync with his ideas than almost anyone else's. But still, I think that was probably going to happen with or without homeschooling. Mm-hmm. I don't think that Captain Fantastic actually changed his kids to the extent that they would otherwise have become libertarians or something.
Yep. Yeah, so like when I was blogging this movie, I was saying, God, I would just love to teach Econ 1 for the whole Cash family because... They learn it. They can actually learn it. And once they learned it, they'd never be the same again. Ideally. The dad would be the hardest case, but, you know, he'd be talking back. But still, he'd get something out of it. I really, really think he would.
Yeah.
Which there are more people like the Cash family.
Absolutely. They're not like your normal communists.
Yes. Some of them were, yeah, so at least Bodavon Cash was a Maoist, self-identified.
They're all super left-wing.
Yeah.
At the very least.
Right. I mean, so the thing that strikes me whenever those old brainwashing stuff is, wait, doesn't regular school brainwash people? Like, well, yeah, like, so what kind of brainwashing, if any, did you experience in K-6?
Let's see. Well, so every morning we would have to do the Pledge of Allegiance.
That's not brainwashing, that's our country.
Well, I think we might want to go back to 1984, book by George Orwell, to make our minds up about that. You might say that there's the TV screens. It's about our country, so it's not brainwashing. But the whole point of the book is that it's a society brainwashed.
Yeah. So, yeah, how about the history? How much brainwashing was in the history?
The history instruction was so poor that I feel like the brainwashing, if they were trying to include it, was not put in there. But the main thing I think is like so. In terms of brainwashing, in history at public schooling.
K-6.
So definitely bigger emphasis on like America was basically a good country, and the colonists were basically right about the Declaration of Independence and so on.
They weren't?
No, they were. They were.
Yeah. But were the colonists right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. That's what.
No. What they were, I know what you were taught, but are you suggesting? Are you suggesting that what you were taught might be wrong?
Absolutely. if I had been a colonist back then, I would have been like Reverend Mather Byles, who was a reverend. It was a Tory at the Boston Church. Yeah, it might have actually been the Old North Church. Come to think of it. But anyway, he said, what was the exact quote again? Let's see. Why should we listen to a thousand tyrants 3 miles away?
Why should we prefer
a thousand tyrants 3 miles away than one tyrant 3,000 miles away? And I'd be like, oh, yeah, that seems like a perfect point. Seems like the new guys are going to be just as worse or possibly even worse than the last guy. And if we just let things smoothly roll along.
Yeah, what do you think about brainwashing in public school, Tristan?
Of course they brainwash you, and you know some of it is just like the Pledge of Allegiance and stuff. You know, when I went to the high school orientation, they had everyone stand up to the Pledge of to singing the national anthem. I didn't stand, but you know that was probably because I wasn't brainwashed.
only a brainwashed person would refuse to conform to the rest of society.
Anyway, you can tell it. Only a brainwashed person would refuse to stand up with the Nazis. It's a definite sign of brainwashing if everyone in the room is doing the same thing. If it's like a crowd of 1,200 people and they're all standing up to the same thing, you get a bit of a chill from it. It's kind of like watching a Nazi rally. It's not like watching a Nazi rally, but you realize that the Nazis had a way of getting people to be on their side. They were very popular. People did what they were told. And part of it was because they were so charismatic.
All right. So, now let's go, set aside the questions of the audience and Let's just talk about some ideas. All right. Let's see. So we've done a whole lot of European history. How about your favorite European monarch from 1450 to the present?
Yeah, I would probably say Henry IV of France, who reigned 1589-1610. So, you know, here was a man who, unlike his predecessors and successors, was, you know, explicitly stated that his interest was not to conquer Jerusalem back from the infidel or anything like that, but to have a chicken in every hearth. I feel like he was willing to say, like, at a time when tons of people were going crazy about religion and so on, he was willing to set down his faith for the good of France and stop the bloodshed, because he was willing to bend the knee at the altar, as he said. Paris is well worth a mass.
Wait, is he the guy who had his famous edict?
Yeah, he issued the Edict of Nantes in 1598. This was by no means like a full issue of toleration for the Huguenots of France, but like it set out a number of towns, cities, and fortresses where they could worship freely. Sadly, revoked by his successor, Louis XIV, in 1685.
All right, Tristan, your favorite European monarch?
Yeah, Henry IV's a good choice. I think I like Joseph II of Austria a little more, though. He's the kind of guy that I like because he's responsible with trying to bring religious toleration to a large extent. He sponsors Mozart. I've always got a soft spot for anyone who sponsors a great classical musician like Mozart.
But isn't he the one who wanted to have the really pessimistic tombstone?
Yes, here is a man who...
Yeah, here is a man who, with the best intentions, never succeeded in anything. That was the epitaph he proposed. Yeah, I don't think it actually...
And I think that's pretty much right. He was a European monarch who had some of the best intentions I've ever seen. Normally, these people just want to murder their way into power and take hold and have an iron fist, tax people, kill, slaughter, whatever. But Joseph II, he was just trying to bring religious toleration. He was trying to make things better. And yeah, is he a hypocrite? Yeah, he probably was. If he really wanted to do that, he'd, you know, be like trying to sell his giant palaces and live less extravagantly. You know, like all these European monarchs do that. And hey, I mean,
how is that different from typical American billionaire living high and letting die?
Well, normally American billionaires have earned it. The monarch.
Oh, right. The monarchs didn't earn their fortunes. They inherited them fair and square, didn't they?
I mean, you could say that a southern slave owner inherited his slaves as well.
The palaces weren't screaming.
No. The palaces once again were built from the toil of the slaves who were built.
These palaces were built on the
euphemistically called serfs.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah. When was serfdom abolished in Austria?
Actually, 1848. This was after the revolutions and.
So that's de jure abolition of serfdom.
Yes. Yeah. But I mean,
there's almost no serfdom.
So when
in Austria proper, like serfdom is practically non-existent by 1848. But the empire is so massive, you go up to Hungary, and serfdom is continues until 1848 in large numbers.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, Maria Theresa of Austria screws with that too.
Yeah.
God, I hate her.
All right, so, you know, so this is a policy question. I think it was a joke, but it's actually a good question from Christian Madan. So, zoning its effect on growth, or just how about talk about American housing policy through an economic lens? What about Tristan? How about Tristan starts?
So American housing policy is a travesty, I'd say. They're trying to prevent stuff from being built in places where people want stuff to be built.
Who's they?
Anyone who likes to live in New York, say, or say San Francisco. There's lots of people who want to.
Wait, the people who want to are stopping it?
Huh?
The people who want to are stopping it, or they're being stopped?
No, the people who want to
are being stopped. Who's stopping them?
Mostly government agencies and so on with their regulations saying that you can't do it.
Huh. Is there a 5-letter abbreviation for the people who are behind this?
NIMBYs.
NIMBYs, yeah. What are NIMBYs?
Not in my backyard.
Yeah, so can you elaborate on this? So, like, what are some of the regulations that are keeping housing from being built?
For instance, in Silicon Valley, you have the problem of, like, buildings can't be built too high, and they can't really be built to the left or right, so you need to build down, basically. Uh-huh. There's that, so, with it, yeah. so that's a problem there. In Washington D.C., there's a regulation which says that no building can be taller than the Capitol building.
Yeah, I think it's the Capitol Building.
So stuff like that. Typical.
Right, and then, so how about just saying that land, you're not allowed to build on some land?
Yep.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
And of course, there's the classic problem of a foreigner wants to move to the United States. That's not allowed. Even if they want to say build a house there.
Actually, that reminds me of something else. So, you guys are actually the children of immigrants, aren't you? So, in my work, I one of my main specialties is the social science and philosophy of immigration. I'm working on a nonfiction graphic novel on this with artist Zach Wienersmith of Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. But I often forget that my own sons are the children of immigrants because my wife came from Romania when she was 7. So, what is it like being a second generation immigrant?
I never really thought of myself that way.
Wait, are you saying that you're assimilated?
Yeah, I would say I'm pretty assimilated to this strange subculture. I'm by no means a normal American, but I'm assimilated.
Yes,
you would be classified as American, right?
Yeah, there we are.
I'm assimilated to the subculture of Carol Hoff.
Yes, and Tristan. So yeah, what is it like being a second generation immigrant?
Well, it's a lot like being, I suppose, just a normal person. I don't think being a second generation immigrant and just being a normal American guy seems pretty similar to me.
What's the most Romanian thing about you?
You like meat. Romanian sausage.
I mean, I don't like... I dislike almost all Romanian food, and that would be the most obvious thing. I speak Romanian. Okay. How about that? Okay. That's the most Romanian thing about me, because almost no one can speak Romanian.
Yes. So. Do you have a short greeting for our Romanian listeners?
Short greeting.
Just Romanian version of... hi to all of you people out there in Romanian radio land. Well, we can go back to that. Do you feel like you got the words?
I'd say hello, more or less. Buona ziua.
Yes. Well, I can say buona ziua.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't because you said it wrong.
Buona ziua.
No.
Yo son Papagal? You know what that means?
No.
I'm a parrot. And Yo sunt satul. I am full. Very, very useful thing to know if you're dining with Romanians, because they will push food on you. All right, let's see. Other fun historical or economic questions to deal with. Let's see. So... what do you think would have happened in the 20th century if Vladimir Lenin had been successfully assassinated by our hopeful relative Fania Kaplan? Right, we don't actually know. He was shot by a woman named Fania Kaplan. She could be a relative. We got no idea, but let's just hope. But anyway, so suppose that Fania had been successful. How do you think the 20th century history would have been different, Tristan?
I mean, possibly it was too late already, and the communists had seized enough control that somebody would have calmly replaced Lenin, and he would have been almost as fanatical.
Who do you think it would have been, actually?
Yeah, it's a tough question. It probably wouldn't have been Stalin.
He's lower ranked than...
I don't think it would have been Trotsky.
Maybe he is
the head of the Red Army.
Yeah, he's got the army. He's a Johnny come lately.
Yeah, he is.
And so. Yvonne come lately.
I think Trotsky's a likely choice anyway. But anyway, I don't think it would. It probably would have been someone less bad than Stalin, because it's hard to believe that there's anyone that could be much worse than Stalin. Anyway, I think it roughly would have progressed the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there wouldn't have been such terrible famines or something if there had been any leader, but I think the USSR still would have gone on to become a great power, probably.
Yep. And what if he had just dropped dead on the train before he got to the Finland station? Then what, Aiden?
Yeah, that changes things dramatically, I would say, so... Mm-hmm. I think the story in Richard Pipes describes that Lenin was very narrowly averted capture by an imperial patrol while on his way to Petrograd. He got out of it by pretending he was drunk, and so they waved him through.
But Richard Pipe says, and I think recently, that if like he had been captured there, who knows what would have happened? I don't think it would have been Bolshevikism in Russia. Mm-hmm. I think that
Bolshevism.
Bolshevism. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, were there still Imperial Guards? I thought he was coming back after the Kerensky took over.
Yeah, it's like as to what they would be. Maybe they're knows? Yeah.
Right. I mean, at that time they were sort of releasing all their political prisoners. So.
Right. Yeah. But he would have been apprehended.
Yeah. But if they had kicked him back out or something.
I think that very well could have changed things. But if there's one thing super forecasting tells you, it's a little hard to see what's going to happen afterwards.
let's talk about that. So one of the books that I signed this summer was political psychologist Philip Tetlock's book Super Forecasting. Mm-hmm. So Tristan, you want to give people the gist of Super Forecasting?
Yeah, so the basic gist of super forecasting is that almost everything you think about predictions is wrong, right now probably, because the language you use is almost always very vague. So for instance, when I just said almost always, what percentage of forecasts do I think are vague? Do you know that? Maybe my definition of almost always is like 99%.
What do you mean by vague?
What do you mean by vague? Yeah, so like you have to define things, you have to assign probabilities to them, and like normal English is just not very good at that. What probability do you assign to May? Well, I guess literally it's like what, more than 0.00001%, or like less than 100%. That's not very definitive or anything. Mm-hmm. So the basic idea is that people should stop what they're doing and think more about assigning probabilities to words, thinking about what exactly they're literally saying, defining what they've just said, stuff like that.
Huh. And Aiden, so how does Tetlock even arrive at these conclusions? Has he got any actual evidence?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first part of his book is just comparing what he calls super forecasters, so like people in a study who have done really well at forecasting, and then comparing them
There's a tournament.
Yeah, there's a tournament. Yeah. It was like the Good Judgment Project.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Right. Yeah, so they do amazingly well. Contrary to my economic thoughts, they even beat futures markets and stuff like that. So, which is fairly surprising to me. But
Tristan. So, what are some of the traits of super forecasters? People who are in the very top of the forecasting tournament.
Yep, so super forecasters tend to be very easy to tame, so they're very open to new ideas. Yeah, very open to tame, accepting that the idea that their original idea might be wrong, their original probability. Let's see, what else? So they don't like to attribute anything to one and any probability to like one big scheme. Tetlock has this thing about foxes and hedgehogs. Mm-hmm. And hedgehogs are basically people that have like one big theory to explain everything, whereas foxes are just have a lot of different theories. They try to adjust things, and super forecasters tend to be more like foxes. They don't have this one big theory to explain everything.
They generally reject fate and so on. And,
they reject fate. Yeah, they don't think that everything is preordained or anything, and. Mm-hmm. They're strong believers in things like hindsight bias. It's like, you know, they just say like it's hard to judge. It's easy to say that was definitely going to happen after it happened, but actually, like at the time, it must have seemed pretty crazy.
Tend to Fermiize.
Fermi. Yeah, can you tell us about Fermiization, Aiden?
Yeah, sure. So this was basically developed by Enrico Fermi, an Italian scientist who moved to the United States initially to work on the atomic program. But anyway, so he had this experiment, or not really experiment, but question: how many piano tuners are there in Chicago? Is the example which Tetlock uses, and most of his students just like they just like think about it for one, and they say, and they just like give a number, like more or less taken out of what Tetlock calls the black box. All right, but then Fermiizing the question, you can ask like four more questions which you might know the answer to, like how many people are there in Chicago, how many families are there in Chicago, you can take guesses,
what share have pianos?
Yeah, well, like what share? Yeah, exactly. What share would have pianos? How often do pianos need to be tuned? It's like you narrow this down, you might not have a good idea about any of the questions. But the remarkable thing is that when you come out with an answer, it's going to be more accurate probably than just reaching into your black box and picking a number.
With his Fermiizing, which seems very reasonable, Tetlock comes out with a number of 63, and the actual number appeared to be at the time 87, so it's quite remarkable that...
He's off by 20%! He doesn't know anything!
He's off by one. He's only off by...
Oh yeah, some people might be off by a factor of 100, right? Yeah. Quite possibly. All right, so we also spent quite a bit of time doing psychology. Not so much as a class, but just learning basic ideas. So can you tell us about action bias, Tristan?
Sure. So action bias is the idea that people tend to want to do something a lot more than they want to do nothing. As Tyrion Lannister said in, I believe, the last Game of Thrones episode, when Daenerys asks what she should do, and Tyrion says, nothing! So nothing is sometimes the hardest thing to do. And yeah, nothing is sometimes the hardest thing to do, but I think it's doing nothing is highly underrated. If, like you're saying, should we launch missiles into some country? Saying, do you think that's a good idea? I don't know, but it's probably better to launch missiles into a country with rebels than not to. Is that right? I don't think you have any good reason to believe that.
Yeah, so. It's kind of like, you know, if you're a politician and someone says, what do you propose to do about something? Right now, even if you don't have any good ideas, you're generally better off proposing some stupid idea than just saying, I've got nothing. If something good comes along, I'll let you know.
Because it sounds bad to say we should do nothing.
Yes.
Yeah, so it sounds like you've got no answer.
Yes.
And you're an idiot.
Yeah. Yep.
When really you might be the smartest person in the room.
All right, so... One last psychology question, and then I think it's about time to wrap it up. So, I feel like if I had known about this one psychological effect when I was a kid, it would have made my whole childhood much better. So, I'm wondering if you guys can explain it to our listeners. So, this is the spotlight effect. What is it, and what does it mean?
I was actually thinking you might say the spotlight effect. All right, so the spotlight effect basically states that people overestimate how much other people are paying attention to them. So, for instance, if you're wearing a funny hat and you walk through the mall,
you know, an experiment is a funny shirt.
You have like a beaver skin cap, it's like Davy Crockett, 19th century beaver skin cap. All right, so you like walk through the mall and at the end of the experiment, you're asked, right, so how much attention do you think people paid to you? Like they were probably like paying tons of attention when you were right, freaking out. And then
everyone saw me with my stupid hat. Yeah. I'm so ashamed.
Exactly. And then the researchers go to the people in the mall and ask, did you notice a guy with like a Davy Crockett cap walking around? Like, what? So that's the spotlight effect for you. People, you're almost always overestimating how much attention other people pay to you.
But Tristan, how can this help kids?
Well, let's say that you're weird. And I think there are lots of people listening to this right now who would identify as being weird. Yeah, I identify as being weird. So if you're weird and you like doing weird things and, you know, being weird in general, doing said things will not get you anywhere near as much negative attention as you think it will. Say, just like wearing a shirt with some dice on it, some D20s, right at... And then just going around, maybe you advertise it to a few people who know what D20s are, and they're like, hey, cool, you know, he's got a shirt with some D20s, and almost everyone else just says, I don't know, like, he's a nice shirt or whatever. Or maybe they just don't even know, whatever, that weird kid.
What about all those kids who say, if I do that, everyone will see, and they'll all make fun of me, my life will be over?
Well, they're strongly overreacting. They think they have this idea that the whole world is going to turn its eyes on them as soon as they do anything out of the ordinary, and that's just not true. People have their own lives. They aren't focusing on you. You aren't the center of their attention. Trying to do well in their school or whatever is the center of their attention. Trying to go get to the football game. It's not looking for people in Davy Crockett hats. There's a big world. So even if you damage all the relationships you have at the moment somehow through your weird thing, there's tons of people out there. You could just meet new ones who haven't the foggiest about what's going on.
All right, good thought.
Yeah.
All right, so it's about time to wrap it up. So, closing thoughts. For the last 2 years, the Kaplan family has done something unusual. I think the results speak for themselves, but I know a lot of other people will think otherwise. And the main thing I just say to them is, well, if listening to us for all this time isn't changing your mind, I don't think I'm going to, but Are you really so sure that what we're doing is terrible that you want to stop us? Is it possible? Is it just possible that what we're doing is actually better than what other people are doing and the world could learn from us? I mean, I actually went through the entire system, the entire regular system, regular K through 12. I never liked it. I've got some ideas about how it could be better, and I tried it on my own kids, and my kids seem happy about it. So why shouldn't people at least give me a thumbs up and say, you're doing your thing, maybe you know better than I do, it's really not my place to say? In the end, that's really all I ask. What do you know? So, closing thoughts for you, Tristan?
I think it's been a great experience. I've learned a lot. I've become a far better thinker. I know so many more things. And I think that homeschooling has just made me a better intellectual, and I'll learn from this, no doubt.
All right. And, but miserable the whole time?
No. I was always far, far happier than I was in public school.
And how about you, Aiden? You got any concluding thoughts?
You can take the boy out of homeschooling, but you can't take the homeschooling out of the boy. That's my story. And I'm really thankful for that, because the homeschooling, in my opinion, has been a wonderful experience. And let me just say, I'm truly grateful, Dad, for all the great stuff you've done for us.
Such a sweet lad. Yep, and really, you know, my biggest privilege has been to teach kids like this, because kids like this are really hard to find. All right. So thanks, everybody, for listening, and... if you ever happen to meet my sons, they're a little shy, but as you might have heard, they got plenty to say. So come to them, ask them some good questions, and you'll make some friends that I say are very worth having. So talk to everybody later. Bye.